to the toxic cleanups. They're the ones doing this cleanup. And you have Miller saying, we got to expand these arrests to 3,000 a day, which, how can they do that but go to work sites and find active workers?
Well, they are saying that they are not going to go to the places that have been impacted by the fires. But they were here staying at the hotel in Pasadena. Unfortunately, the community, people from all walks of life. By the way, it's not just migrant families that are coming out to protest the presence of ICE in our communities. It's people from all walks of life that are coming. Soccer moms. I've never seen that. Protesting to protect immigrant workers. We have the council members coming out, the political class, everybody coming out.
Before we end, you're from El Salvador. You fled El Salvador. Now President Trump is sending people back to El Salvador, where the president of El Salvador himself calls himself a dictator. If you can respond to this possibility and what people are facing when they're deported to the places where their very lives were threatened.
You know, your question reminds me about all of this narrative about gangs. And I just want to remind Americans that gangs are a creation of this country. And when gang members were deported to El Salvador, the gang problem was exported from the U.S. to El Salvador. And
Well,
Bukele has established a state of exception in El Salvador, and it appears that now Mr. Trump wants to import that state of exception to the United States. And it's unacceptable, and it's un-American, and we're going to fight it.
We're going to continue this conversation in Spanish and post it on our Spanish website at democracynow.org/ES. I want to thank you, Pablo Alvarado, and remind people still hundreds of people from the United States have been deported to CECOT, the maximum security prison in El Salvador. Thank you.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Camp KABU is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this summer membership drive special of the KABU Evening News, wildfires rage in the gorge with hundreds under evacuation orders. Oregon and Washington senators demand to know why key firefighting personnel are not in place. And Oregon and the nation get ready for big No Kings protests this weekend. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, June 12, 2025. KABU is currently in our summer membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Lift up our wildfire fighters tonight.
Thousands of people are under evacuation orders as at least three wildfires are burning in the gorge on both the Oregon and Washington sides. Oregon State Senator Daniel Bonham represents the area and lives there, describing the situation.
I just got noticed again. We're at level one in our house, which is just get ready. My in-laws, though, are the get set. And I know a bunch of people in my community that are the go. I've talked to both the Department of Forestry, who has a team out there, and the state fire marshal. They're throwing air assets at this fire out. It's Rowena going over the Rowena crest into the west side of the Dalles. But it'll be a sleepless night for a lot of firefighters and for a lot of residents out in the Dalles. If you would be lifting them up in prayers, I'd appreciate it.
The Rowena fires destroyed at least 20 homes so far. And as the wildfire season is underway, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley confronted U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz, saying the Trump administration's funding freezes and mass firings have left the state and the nation dangerously unprepared.
Many people have been very concerned about the teams that we have ready to fight in the upcoming forest fire season. How many permanent firefighters do we have on board today, and how many seasonal firefighters do we have on board?
Senator, in terms of the firefighters we've hired to date, we have just under 11,000 that we've brought on board. And those are GS9 and below, so that's our primary firefighting force. Our goal is to have about 11,300 at full capacity. So we're actually a little bit ahead of where we were last year at this time in terms of our overall hiring of our firefighting force.
It was pointed out to me back in Oregon that a lot of the folks who have signed up for the firefighter season are actually also accepting positions in other places because they're applying multiple places and getting multiple acceptances. Are we pretty confident that those 11,000 are going to show up?
Senator, yes, we are confident.
The other concern has been not just the front line, but also the management teams, the complex incident management teams. How many teams do we believe we're going to be able to deploy, and how does that compare to a year ago?
So currently we have 37 teams nationally, and those are not all Forest Service teams. About 50% of the personnel in those teams are staffed by Forest Service personnel. There's also Department of Interior personnel. There's also states and that also support those teams. So we have 37 today, and approximately a year ago, we probably had closer to 42 teams.
And are you working to get to that 42 number? Or?
Yes, sir. I think that the team discussion is a broader discussion. There's been a decline in team participation for years. And I think part of it is just a lot of people do that as an additional duty. It's not a primary responsibility. So I think there's opportunities to talk about on an ongoing basis how we better structure teams, and does that become a more permanent role, or do we continue to do it with volunteers? Because right now, team participation is largely based on volunteers.
What we had heard back home was that we lost a lot of folks who participate in these teams due to the firings and the early retirements that were offered. And is that a piece of why we're at 37 instead of 42?
Senator, so keep in mind, like 50% of the personnel are just Forest Service. There's other personnel that are also contributing. I don't know the extent that's had the impact, but what I can tell you is we've had about 1,400 people take DRP that had fire quals. We recently reached out to ask them if they had an interest in coming back. We just opened that up about a week ago. The secretary has been very clear that she wants them to come back if they have an interest, and we are going to work through that process. So the numbers are still in flux. We'll know more over the next week to 2 weeks.
Can you explain to the public what a DRP is?
So that's the deferred resignation program. That's where people voluntarily leave the agency, and it's like a severance package.
So the picture this is painting is $43.25 million is being shifted out of state grants. It's being shifted into program salaries because the plan, as you have laid out for FY26, is to shut down all of these programs.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I can tell you, vast disagreement with this strategy. I think it's a violation of the trust between Congress and the Forest Service because Congress laid out a vision, and you're not continuing the programs. You're cutting them in half, and you're doing it in shifting funds, saying we know what's going to happen in FY26, we're going to shut down these programs. The executive branch is about executing the programs, and I don't anticipate that Congress is going to shut down those programs. So isn't it a betrayal of the relationship to be cutting programs in half in preparation for shutting them down completely when the vision has not been laid out by Congress?
Senator, I think what we recognize is that there is some flexibility in how we do this, and we do know that we have a need to cover the cost of the DRP payments. So we can't go into a deficit spending model, so we thought that was the most prudent way to go about doing this.
The idea of shifting from real work on the ground to paying personnel expenses and doing a lot less work on the ground is absolutely not in concert with the vision laid out by Congress.
Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray also had tough questions for U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz about preparations for wildfire season.
In my home state of Washington, wildfires are a constant threat, as you well know. And when we invest in fire prevention, we save lives, we save entire communities. One of the most important investments we make is in the people who do that work. But President Trump is throwing all of that work into jeopardy right now. He's pushed out nearly 7,500 skilled employees across the Forest Service, either by firing them outright or pressuring them to leave under threat of losing their job later down the line. That includes at least 500 Forest Service employees in the Pacific Northwest. But we hardly know the full scope of the damage because the administration won't share critical information with us. I have spoken with countless Forest Service workers from Washington State who loved their job. They played an important role in fighting those fires and are gone now, thanks to Trump. Setting aside the proposal for a consolidated firefighting agency, this budget proposes a $1.4 billion cut, that is 40%, to the Forest Service non-fire programs at a time when our nation's trees from our backyards to backcountry are under stress, and we need to step up the pace of forest health and resiliency to withstand these catastrophic wildfires. On top of all that, the Forest Service has illegally withheld federal funds to help reduce wildfire risk and is currently not distributing $97 million to support state, rural, and volunteer fire departments. That is a huge threat to our communities. I represent in Washington State who have told me personally this administration is putting them in danger by gutting our ability to respond to wildfires. So, Chief Schultz, I do appreciate your service to our country. I realize you are not making all the decisions here, but I am profoundly concerned about this administration's reckless decision to mass fire and push out essential Forest Service employees across the country. The administration claimed that no firefighters have been fired, but the reality is on the ground, we have lost workers whose jobs are absolutely essential. Nearly every single Forest Service worker supports fire operations in some capacity. Trail maintenance crews, for instance, ensure access to routes remain clear for firefighting personnel and equipment. Biologists conduct essential environmental assessments that inform prescribed burns and fuel reduction strategies. Other support staff, ecologists, engineers, maintenance workers, camp managers, receive firefighter training, and they are actually mobilized during peak fire season to bolster our frontline firefighting crews. So, Chief Schultz, was there any formal analysis conducted to determine the potential effect of the mass firings for wildfire preparedness?
Senator Murray, thank you for the question. We did not have a mass firing.
I'm talking about across the board, pushing people out, early retirement,
right, so
doing
wanna,
all the things.
Right. I just want to clarify. So we did have two rounds of that deferred resignation program, and that was about 4,200 people that left voluntarily. And then we had another.
Because they didn't know what's
right. Didn't know what's going. I don't disagree with you. And we had another 600 that took voluntary early retirement. So there was no, in terms of their incentives for people to leave, we did not know who was going to leave. Obviously, it was a voluntary process. So what we've done is when they did leave, we've been moving people to, we call that lateral movement, and we've been doing that across the agency, and we've moved probably close to 600 or 700 people to fill those critical vacancies. When it comes to the fire piece specifically, we had about 1,400 people that had fire quals that did leave, and we have reached out to those folks to secure their services this fire season to see if they want to come back on a voluntary basis to function on their team.
It just seems really ridiculous that it was done this way, which was my question actually. Was there an analysis done before this was all done to realize the impacts of these people that you're now trying to find and bring back?
Senator, so we couldn't do the analysis because we didn't know who was going to leave because it was voluntary. We didn't go handpick.
Well, I want to get on, but I just said the stakes are life and death here, and this is really raises serious alarms about this agency being ready for this critical fire season. Interior Secretary Burgum told this committee that on the ground wildfire operations would not be affected by the administration's staffing cuts, but we know that's not true. In the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest, one firefighter barracks recently and abruptly lost power. And it stayed without power, not for a few hours or a day, but for weeks. Why? Because the maintenance workers in that forest had been pushed out the door. There was no ability to put even a small purchase on a credit card because the card limit was drastically decreased. And there was no one left to process a basic contract to get that repair done. This is what happens when administrative staff disappear. It's not just an inconvenience. It directly affects whether firefighters have a safe place to sleep, whether they have power, whether they can be deployed effectively. Maybe Elon didn't care about the maintenance crew, but turns out they are pretty important. And this is not an isolated incident. I have heard so many stories. Administrative staff responsible for coordinating travel for crews when a fire breaks out, gone. People who made sure fire response teams had their fuel and supplies ready, they're gone. And all of this is happening as we now head in straight into what is going to be a dangerous fire season in Washington State. So, Chief Schultz, tell us, do you believe the Forest Service is ready for wildfire season, given this absence of critical administrative and support staff? Do you believe they are ready?
Senator, thank you for the question. Yes, I do believe they're ready. And then some of the credit card issues you're talking about, we have adjusted those. We've had increases in cards. We've been moving people into lateral positions to ensure critical vacancies that we're clear that we can fill those.
I can just tell you from on the ground, it feels like we are not prepared for this wildfire season. You just said we were. We will see what happens, but I fear I'm going to be right. Now, the president supposedly wants to increase timber output from federal lands by 25%. But here's the problem. This same administration is simultaneously cutting budgets, delaying funding, freezing hiring, and reducing staff at the Forest Service, the very agency that is responsible for that work. So how exactly is that going to work? Who's going to consult with the tribes? Who's going to lay out the sale plans? Who's going to mark the timber? Who's going to manage compliance and issue contracts when field offices have been literally decimated? Is the expectation, Chief Schultz, is it really the expectation that these fewer people with fewer resources, less support, can somehow deliver work at a faster pace and with greater complexity? How is that realistic?
I think it's an iterative process. We don't have all the answers today, but in terms of how we're going to get there, we're going to, again, fill critical vacancies. We're also going to have to lean on partners differently. So the states in Washington, they have a very aggressive good neighbor program. So
yeah, the states are being relied on for just about virtually everything. And I got to tell you, firefighters don't sit, as my partner from Oregon knows, they do not sit in one state.
That's right. But to your point, though, we are going to be working with partners in a different way. We're going to have different kind of contracting terms that we're going to have, looking at longer term.
Well, that begs the question. So do you have some kind of plan for this that's going to be executed over the next year? Because the wildfire season is here right now and critical employees are not in place.
So when it comes to the wildfire season, yes, ma'am, we do have the critical folks in place. When it comes to administering the timber program that you're talking about, we're building that right now. So that's part of what we're doing is we're building that process, those interim operating plans. We're working on that right now. Yes, ma'am.
When will we see that?
I would suspect in the next couple months we'll have that whole plan figured out how we're going to execute that for the next 4 years. That's what we're working on right now.
And that was U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Schultz answering questions from Washington, U.S. Senator Patty Murray. Audience members and President Donald Trump just got a surprise at the Kennedy Center opening of Les Mis. Cable News reporter Josh Salem tells us more.
Last February, Donald Trump dismissed all the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts board members appointed by his predecessor and the president and board chair. Trump himself became board chairman and filled the body with his supporters, making the traditionally bipartisan board overtly political. He was apparently trying to excise what he described as liberal ideology. On Wednesday night, audience members at the center took a small measure of revenge, booing and even cursing his name. Trump was present at the time, attending the opening night of Les Miserables. It was his first time attending a show there since his election, and he was both booed and cheered as he took his seat alongside First Lady Melania Trump. Several drag artists were in the crowd, their presence allegedly a protest against Trump's complaints that the Kennedy Center had hosted too many drag shows in the past. Trump seems to have a particular affection for Les Mis, a sprawling musical set in 19th century France. He occasionally plays its songs at his events. One of them, Do You Hear the People Sing, is a rallying cry inspired by the 1832 rebellion against the French king. California Governor Gavin Newsom just wrote, quote, someone explained the plot to him, end quote, on social media. Before Trump's recent actions, presidential involvement in Kennedy Center affairs had been limited to naming members to the Board of Trustees and occasionally attending the taping of its annual Fall Honors Program. But after returning to office in January, Trump promised to overhaul center programming, management, and even appearance. The administration's moves have upset many of the center's patrons and performers. In March, the audience booed Vice President J.D. Vance after he slipped into the upper level to hear the National Symphony Orchestra. Sales of subscription packages have declined since Trump's takeover, and several touring productions, including Hamilton, canceled planned runs at the center. At least one actor and a musician canceled scheduled appearances, and at least two Kennedy Center consultants resigned. It is believed understudies may have performed in some roles Wednesday night because of boycotts by regular Les Mis cast members, but Trump said he was not bothered. He said, quote, I couldn't care less. Since returning to the White House in January, Trump adopted an aggressive posture toward the arts, The administration has tried to cancel millions of dollars in previously awarded federal humanities grants to arts and culture groups, and he proposed eliminating the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. He has also signed executive orders to restrict Smithsonian Museum funding. Trump characterized previous programming at the Kennedy Center as, quote, out of control with rampant political propaganda, and said it featured inappropriate shows, including a Marxist anti-police performance and lesbian-only Shakespeare. The Kennedy Center, which is supported by government money and private donations, opened in 1971. It was conceived in the late 1950s during the administration of Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, who supported a bill from the Democratic-led Congress calling for a national culture center. In the early 60s, Democratic President John F. Kennedy launched a fundraising initiative, and his successor, President Lyndon B. Johnson, signed into law a bill renaming the project the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, down to an overnight low of 49. Tomorrow, cloudy. A rain chance in the morning, high of 68. Today in history, on this date in 1975, Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, was found guilty of election fraud. The quote of the day is from Gandhi. Winning or losing the election is less important than strengthening the country. The Washington State Legislature passed a number of bills this session aimed at protecting gay and trans rights, including a controversial bill that expands students' privacy for counseling they get at school. And as trans rights continue to spark political action throughout the country, one Washington-based nonprofit is responding. Isabel Charlet has the story.
June is Pride Month, and Washington's Lavender Rights Project is celebrating with a Black trans comedy showcase. This is the largest fundraiser of the year for the nonprofit, which provides legal and social services for Black trans people. Angel Patterson of Lavender Rights says in the wake of increased attacks on trans rights across the country, the showcase prioritizes the community's health, safety, and joy.
We are your family, too. We are your mothers, your brothers, your sisters, your aunties, uncles, cousins, friends, bosses, coworkers. We're all paying parking tickets and taxes the same as everyone else.
He says the showcase will be on June 14th and will feature performers from Washington and across the country, including T.S. Madison and Mix Dahlia Bell. So far, 923 bills targeting trans rights have been introduced across the country this year, and over 100 have passed. Patterson explains that the idea for the showcase came after hearing trans people used as punchlines for jokes in the media.
Instead of a traditional protest, we wanted to reclaim our power in another way that felt sacred to us. And this event is truly that. And it's a wonderful night to bring our folks together and highlight our work and really just feel the power of pride.
The comedy showcase will also have auction items to help raise money for the project, such as plane tickets, glass blowing classes, concert, and sports tickets. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
In Oregon, Washington, and throughout the country, organizers are planning No Kings protests this weekend. As Alex Gonzalez reports, they plan a day of defiance against what they call the Trump administration's extreme agenda.
Protests are planned this Saturday as organizers mobilize a nationwide day of defiance against what they're calling the Trump administration's attacks on civil rights, working families, public education, and health care. The No Kings protests follow a week of immigration sweeps throughout the country that have sparked public outrage against President Donald Trump's mass deportation agenda and immigration and customs enforcement. This week, the president said folks can expect additional ICE raids and warned protesters they can expect to be met with equal or greater force. But Leah Greenberg with the advocacy organization Indivisible says there's power in collective action.
This is coming at a moment when they are illegally sending troops into Los Angeles, intentionally attempting to escalate in order to justify broader crackdowns on dissent. That makes it so much more important for all of us collectively to be in solidarity with our immigrant friends and neighbors with basic American values.
The widespread movement will run counter to Trump's projected multi-million dollar birthday military parade happening in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. More than 100 pro-democracy groups are backing the nationwide No Kings events. To find where protests are happening, visit nokings.org. Greenberg argues that the Trump administration is actively attempting to chill dissent and create consequences for those who speak out. She claims the administration is trying to create a false sense of inevitability.
Their power fundamentally is dependent on all of us actually agreeing, actually obeying. If we collectively organize, if we collectively expose that lie for what it is, then we are going to be in a completely different position, and they are not going to be able to get away with the things that they're trying to do.
President of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, wants to remind folks the power of the United States government is derived from those it represents.
Not from one man, not from one party, not from a crown. That is what was the most important focus of the framers. That is why they shed lots of blood, sweat, and tears to actually create this country.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
And last night, protesters camped outside of the ICE facility for a fifth night. Dozens of police officers showed up around 11 p.m. and tried to remove the protesters, but their efforts were in vain. At about 1 a.m., the police retreated. The protesters remain. Governor Tina Kotek said in a press release on Monday, quote, "I support your right to peacefully demonstrate. It's a cornerstone of American democracy. Please know that I will do everything in my power to protect the rights and safety of our residents, including the immigrant community. But I also want to be clear, violence, harm to public safety workers, or the destruction of property will not be tolerated." In a post, the official ICE out of Portland Instagram responded to the governor's statement saying, quote, "If our governor's words were true, we would not be dealing with ICE abducting our neighbors daily. Instead, they, government officials, focus on property damage as if it comes close to the terrorism committed by our federal government," end of quote. The petition to revoke ICE's permit to stay in the city, which is to be given to the city council, is continuing to circulate and now has over 5,000 signatures and a new goal of 6,000. And while protests continue across many states, many city and state officials in California work to defend protesters and immigrant communities. Senators, mayors, and the governor of California are all taking a stance against Trump's aggressive act of sending in the National Guard and threatening to send the Marines that is escalating a situation that officials in the area are calling peaceful protest. Today, California Senator Alex Padilla, the Democrat, was forcibly removed when he tried to go to DHS Secretary Kristi Noem's press conference in Los Angeles. Yesterday, in an interview with CBS News, Senator Padilla said he wanted to bring attention to the LA protests being largely peaceful and that it is only a crisis because it is a, quote, crisis of Donald Trump's making. Padilla backed up the people, saying that, quote, "the increasingly aggressive and cruel tactics of the immigration enforcement is what's prompting the response of people who are passionate about speaking up for our fundamental rights and due process," end of quote. He also drew attention to an especially cruel case when ICE agents showed up to an elementary school and ordered a four-year-old who is depending on life-saving treatment to self-deport. California's attorney general and its governor, Gavin Newsom, have filed a lawsuit against Trump for what they call the unnecessary use of force within the state. Arturo Flores, a veteran and California mayor, spoke at a press conference appealing to the military. He said, quote, "These are Americans, and when we lifted our hands and swore an oath to defend this country, that oath was to the American people. It was not to a dictator. It was not to a tyrant. It was not to a president." In Portland, many of us empathize with the protesters in Los Angeles. We remember what it's like to face federal agents and a barrage of tear gas, rubber bullets, pepper spray, and flashbang grenades. As we prepare for a weekend of nationwide protests, KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these thoughts.
Despite the fact that the Los Angeles Police Department described last Friday's anti-ICE protests as generally peaceful, Donald Trump ordered 2,000 National Guard troops into L.A., effectively provoking a crisis where none had existed. He has since ramped up the tension by adding an additional 2,000 from the Guard, as well as 700 U.S. Marines. On Wednesday morning, Trump said, quote, "If our troops didn't go into Los Angeles, it would be burning to the ground right now," conveniently ignoring the fact that this was a crisis that he instigated. Sadly, a disturbing percentage of mainstream American media seems to be playing along with this nonsense, ignoring the fact that there was a tiny pocket of violence in a city that is larger than the states of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. The military invasion of America's second largest city is a continuation of this administration's ongoing demonization of immigrants and its relentless assault on our civil rights. It also serves as a handy distraction as Trump's big, beautiful tax bill slithers its way through Congress. As Portlanders, we well remember the summer of 2020 when we were one of the primary targets of Trump's repressive tactics. And having gone through it once before, I'm sure none of us wants to see another assault on our city by federal forces. But that doesn't mean we should sit idly by in hopes that Trump doesn't notice us. Now more than ever, we have to make our voices heard. And Saturday's nationwide No Kings protest provides just such an opportunity. With protests scheduled in over 1,800 American cities, this nationwide day of defiance is our opportunity to say that we've had enough of the corruption, abuse of power, and growing authoritarianism of the Trump regime. To have a positive impact, we need the turnouts to be large, vocal, and peaceful. And make no mistake, remaining peaceful is of critical importance. Because if we're not peaceful, we play right into Trump's little hands and provide Fox News, the right-wing echo chamber, and even the mainstream media the video clips that will help him and his minions to justify his authoritarian tactics. So on Saturday, I'm planning to join thousands of other Portlanders to voice my anger, but my voice is the only weapon I'll be using. Currently, there are at least 20 No Kings protest locations throughout Oregon, including 4 right here in Portland. And to find out more, you can go to www.nokings.org. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You're listening to a summer...
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Northwest Office Liquidations, a family-owned business in Portland for over 30 years, offering an inventory of office furniture, full-service office design and space planning, and liquidation services. More info at northwestofficeliquidations.com.